Rav Daniel Feldman, Friday, 10th of Shvat, 5778, Jewish perspectives on the death penalty.
And obviously we have other partners as well with Yeshiva University of Israel, Yeshiva University alumni as well, and Garin Yachad. So we have a really great team here. So anyone who would like to volunteer, we could use some extra volunteers. It's really not a lot of work, it's just a little bit of work before the events. We're so delighted to have Rabbi Rosner, Rabbi Feldman here. I'm thinking about the whole program. I'm about to talk about the program, but Rabbi Feldman, it's a great story how it happened. I got four or five phone calls from different people, three of them from America, one from Israel, saying Rabbi Feldman has a wedding and he's looking for a place to give shiurim, and that we thought of you and the Beit Midrash initiative. So, which is a great thing that people in America are calling because they heard about the Beit Midrash initiative and the program that we're doing. So, of course, I called Rabbi Feldman. Rabbi Feldman was just a delight to be on the phone with him, and we decided not just to do Beit Midrash initiative, but also to have a special Givat Sharet Scholar in Residence program. He's speaking tonight here at BMTL at 8:15. You'll be speaking tomorrow morning at Netzach after Shacharit at approximately 10:30, and then at the Nofei HaShemesh he'll be speaking at 3 o'clock, an hour before Mincha, and obviously I'll talk more about the different topics as well. But right now, I just want to get into a quick brief introduction. Rabbi Daniel Z. Feldman is Rosh Yeshiva at Ritz, Yeshiva University. He's the executive editor of the Ritz Initiative of the YU Press. He is a Musma alumnus of Yeshiva Camp Yavne, and received his Smicha, Yor Yora, and Yad Nadin from Reb Zuchanan. Reb Feldman has written numerous Svarim, and we're not going to get into all of them now, but he's gotten also, he's received approbations in his published works from Rav Avram Shapira, Rav Adya Yosef, Rav Natan Gesedner, Rav Zalman Nechemiah Goldberg, Rav Asher Weiss, and others. Rabbi Feldman is currently the rabbi, spiritual leader of Or Sadia of Teaneck, New Jersey, where he resides with his wife, Leah, and his and their children. Without further ado, I'd like to ask Rabbi Feldman to deliver the Kol Yom Shishi, Jewish Perspectives on the Death Penalty Debate.
Thank you so much, Rabbi Thaw, for the introduction and for everything that you've done to make this happen together with the entire committee, and especially Mark Watson and Mike Greenwald and the whole committee for all of the work in putting together this beautiful Shabbos, this beautiful weekend. I'm really quite thrilled to be here for all of the reasons that you mentioned. And I'm sorry that we have to talk about a topic that's a little difficult. It's difficult in many ways. I know that it's a highly controversial issue in Israel at the moment, the question of the death penalty. And I'll tell you right now, I'm not here to make it any easier. I'm not here to make it into a simple topic. If anything, we'll probably leave here with a little bit more confusion than we started with. So I want to lower expectations just to begin with, just so we should appreciate that this is a topic which has many challenges associated with it, and I'm really here to complicate it. I'm here not here to simplify, but to complicate. And the issue, of course, of the perspective of the Israeli government and the challenges that are present in society here are unique in many ways. It involves a convergence of different factors which require special deliberation and special thought. And that's also a part of what I want to call attention to, the fact that this conversation exists in many different spheres, in many different ways, and that's something that we have to be able to appreciate. And the topic is not just controversial here, it's controversial everywhere. It's always been controversial throughout the history. And coming from the United States, The death penalty has been a controversy in America since before there was an America, since before there was an official country. Going back to the time of the colonies, it was a topic that was hotly debated among the founding fathers of America, many of whom were death penalty abolitionists, who were very opposed to the death penalty and were very much a part of active debate about the topic. And there were others who felt it was a very necessary part of society. So we're going to try to draw a little bit from some of the different contexts, and also to emphasize that there are different contexts and that that's a crucial part of the discussion. Because especially, let's say, as an American citizen, so one might ask, okay, let's say if you have a person who is Jewishly learned, and who nowadays, as we know, people of Jewish background have perhaps unique access to positions of power in the United States and elsewhere, and perhaps you can imagine a conversation where somebody in a position of governmental influence will turn to his friend, the rabbi, the yeshiva graduate, and say, tell me, what does the Talmud have to say about this issue? What does Jewish tradition have to say about this question? Here we're debating this crucial issue. So what is the Jewish perspective? And the answer is not simple. I think many people will say that perhaps the approach is that on the one hand, we know that certainly you open up the Torah, you find the death penalty mentioned many, many times. You find the concept certainly present. However, many are also aware of at least one Talmudic source, which appears here on the Mar Makomos, and thank you so much for all the work in putting this together. But the first source is a very familiar source from Gemara Maseches Makos and Dav Zayin Amud Aleph, the Mishnah and the Gemara. It says over here, Sanhedrin ha'oreges echad b'shavua, nekros chavlonis, that if a Sanhedrin kills here, it doesn't mean a week, it means once in 7 years. If a Beis Din executes once in 7 years, that is called a chavlonis, a bloody Beis Din, a violent Beis Din. That's too much. If it happens once in 7 years, that's already too often. And Rabbi Elazar ben Azari Omer Echad L'Shivim Shana. No, 7 years is certainly too often. 70 years is too often. If it happens once in 70 years, that's too much. Now, it's also important to note that you see here in the Gemara that there is a contrasting opinion also. That Rabbi Tarfon, Rabbi Kiva, Omrim, Ilu, Hayinu, B'Sanhedrin, L'Nereg Adam E'olam. So first you have a statement that will go even beyond that. We'll say nobody would ever have been killed had we had been part of the Sanhedrin. Not once in 7 years, not once in 70 years, not at all. So if it stopped there, it would certainly keep getting more extreme. But it's also worth noting Rav Shimon Gamliel's opinion, the last line here, Rav Shimon Gamliel Omer, well, Afhein Marbin Shofchei Damim B'Yisrael. Okay, so then you're going to have a lot of murderers among the Jewish people because everyone's going to know that the penalty is never going to happen to them. So a little bit of a contrasting position before the passage is over. But the first few lines are very well known. The idea that Sanhedrin was very hesitant to impose the penalty, 70 years, never, whatever it is. So the conclusion that many would draw from those two sets of sources, on the one hand, the Torah's frequent mention, on the other hand, these opinions that we see here, is that, yes, the death penalty is supposed to be on the books, it's supposed to be a conceptual possibility, but is never actually supposed to be imposed. That the system should be such that it doesn't actually happen. It should be there theoretically, but it shouldn't actually be used practically. Now, that might be a correct conclusion. I'm not here to say whether it is or isn't, but what we'd like to look at a little bit is that even if that is the correct conclusion, there's a much more involved journey before getting to that. So that's what we'd like to look at for a few minutes. What is it that we have to keep in mind in considering what exactly is a Jewish position towards this question? And what's crucial to note, and also what makes the current question in Israel particularly complicated, is that there are at least three, and maybe we should say there are more, there are at least three contexts for discussions of the death penalty. So if one were to quote any passage, a passage from the Talmud, a passage from the Chumash, a passage from any Jewish source, they could be talking about any of at least three different contexts. On the one hand, we have the Sanhedrin, which imposed the death penalty, at least theoretically, for many offenses, including ritual offenses. we could have the Jewish government of Israel or the Sanhedrin acting in a civil fashion to regulate society in a protective manner. And third, we have the secular court system. Let's say the government calls it court system in the United States, which is a system which is also recognized and addressed by halacha as well. So any reference that we talk about, we need to first ask, where is it coming from? What's the context? Because if we're borrowing from one context to the next, we're not necessarily sure that we're drawing the right conclusions. So let's try to get a little bit of a background in what these contexts involve. But before that, let's take a step back and talk about the question of punishment. So the idea that society acts to punish wrongdoers, the idea that there are penalties of any kind, and particularly the death penalty. So what is behind that? What drives punitive theory in halacha and otherwise? Where is our goal when we talk about imposing a punishment on an offender? What are we trying to accomplish? So there is a very technical debate among the Rishonim, and some of it is here on the sources, that seems really technical and on the surface probably boring, but may have some conceptual significance for us. We have a tradition that there are 613 mitzvos. Why that number is significant and how we assign the 613 mitzvos, a topic of a lot of discussion. And different Rishonim came up with different lists, different ways to get to 613. Now we know, as we mentioned, that imposing the death penalty is, at least theoretically, a commandment in the Torah. So the question comes up, is it one commandment or is it more than that? How do you count among the 613 mitzvos this obligation to impose the punishment of death? So here we have three views in Rishonim. On the one hand, you have the Ramban. The Ramban understands that all of the punishments are all subsumed under one heading, one mitzvah. U'bi'arta hara mikirbech. Next, you have the Rambam. That's represented here by source 2. That the Rambam has the commandment as 4. Why does he have it as 4? Because there are 4 different methods of execution that Talmud talks about. So, okay, but why that's relevant to use as a system, why we should count each one as its own mitzvah and not do it any other way, we'll have to figure that out. But that's how he has 4 separate mitzvahs. And the Bahag went further. The Bahag counted every single time there is an Avera, there is a transgression that gets the death penalty, that's its own mitzvah. 36 mitzvahs. So we have these three opinions, either one mitzvah or 4 mitzvahs or 36 mitzvahs. What in the world difference does it make? Again, seems very technical, very boring. Does it matter? So maybe it does matter. Because let's think about the question for a second. Why would we impose a punishment? And let's talk in a more mundane context. Let's say I'm a teacher, and I throw a student out of class. There's a student talking, and I throw him out of class. In real life, I've never done that, but let's assume that that's the case. I throw the student out of class because he's talking. So why did I do that? What motivated my throwing him out of class? So it could be any of at least 3 reasons. First, maybe I simply can't teach if he's talking in the middle of my class. He's disruptive, and the rest of the class is not going to learn anything. So for the good of the class, I have to remove him. I have to take him out so that the rest of the class can thrive, the rest of the class can learn. That's one possibility. Second possibility might be that I'm not really worried about getting through to the class. I'm more interesting than he is. They're going to listen to me. They're not going to listen to him. It's not such a problem that he's so disruptive. But I have to worry about him. That if it's okay for him to talk and nothing happens, he could violate the rules and there's no consequence. Who knows what kind of a terrible future he has ahead? Who knows what kind of misdeeds he's going to move on to? So therefore, for his sake, for the sake of the offender, I have to stop him now, and I throw him out of class so that he will learn and that he won't continue down this path. So the second theory here is not for the good of the class, it's for the good of the offender, for his own sake. A third reason might be, maybe I'm not so worried about teaching in his presence, I'm more interesting than he is, and I don't care about him so much, I'm a substitute teacher, I'm not so worried about his future. But it's the law. It's a matter of the law that if it says on the wall, no talking in class, and this guy can talk in class and nothing happens, so then the law is meaningless. It doesn't have any impact, doesn't have any bite, so therefore, for the sake of the law, I have to enforce it by saying, sorry, you have to step outside. So that leaves us with three theories. And either we punish for the good of society, the first possibility, the good of the class, or for the good of the offender, which, from the perspective of the death penalty, seems a little bit surprising. How could it be for the good of the offender? It doesn't seem like there's going to be much of a future after that. But from a religious perspective, it is possible, because we believe in a world after this one. So then maybe there is even a possibility of looking at it from that angle as well. And the third possibility is for the good of the law, that we need to show that the Torah actually means what it says. So perhaps those are our three theories, that here we have the Ramban saying it's a bi'ar tahara mikabecha. It's all one idea, that we have to protect society, we have to remove any dangerous influences, whether they're dangerous in a direct physical sense, whether they're dangerous in a spiritual sense, or somewhere in between. Society needs to be protected. It's all under one idea, ubi'ar tahara mikabecha. Second possibility, that it's for the good of the sinner. So that could explain the Rambam's position, because the Rambam, we noted, it's a little strange to use the four methods of execution as a system here. What's the relevance of that? Why is that significant to grouping the mitzvahs that way? So the difference between the four methods of execution, the way the Talmud understands it, is the level of severity. One is considered more severe than the next. So to the extent that it's affecting atonement, that it's bringing about a kapara, so it corresponds to different levels of necessary atonement. Essentially, it's a way of saying, give first degree atonement, second degree atonement, third degree, whatever is going to correspond. So essentially, the Rambam is focusing on that difference, on associating the atonement with the categorizing of the mitzvah, apparently focusing on what does the sinner, so to speak, need to go into the next world with a clean slate. And the third possibility, the Bahag, who's counting each one separately, is apparently saying that here we have mitzvos of the Torah, 36 mitzvos, and each time the Torah is also saying, make sure that it's enforced, this specific mitzvah has bite, has meaning, and that if someone violates it, it's not going to be ignored, but there's going to be an attention paid, there's going to be a significance to that commandment. So these three theories are part of the discussion in general in terms of the nature of punishment. What is it that we're trying to accomplish? And presumably they're all true. Presumably there is a component of all of them, depending on the circumstance and the situation. And assuming we're talking about the Sanhedrin, we're talking about the classical Jewish court system, so then it does seem that all of these are here, and even as we've associated them with different Rishonim, different points of focus, presumably each Rishon would agree with the other that that's also a part of the story, that a kapara and protecting society and protecting the law are all a part of the mix. The question is just, what are they focusing on? What are they emphasizing? But certainly all of these aspects are a part of the discussion. So when we look at the Sanhedrin, certainly all of this plays in. And the Sanhedrin certainly is understood within a mitzvah context. So to start with the Sanhedrin, so the notion that execution was meant to be and actually was extremely rare, if even that, certainly has a lot to support it. And the system was certainly set up in such a way that it was very unlikely that there would be any execution. So the same way, nowadays, maybe one has to hire a fancy lawyer to avoid being convicted, you have to hire a fancy lawyer to get executed in Sanhedrin. It's very, very difficult. The system inherently is set up so that the standard is incredibly challenging. So you have to, first of all, be identified as the offender by two witnesses. The witnesses have to have all the qualifications of witnesses like we have in a wedding nowadays. They have to be two adult observant Jewish males, not related to each other or to anybody involved. So already, how likely is it that somebody is going to transgress in that context, especially when the stakes are so high? But that's really the least of it. It gets harder after that, because these witnesses not only have to see what's happening, but they have to first interact with the person who is committing this avera, and they have to warn him. They have to give what we call hasra, and here it gets even harder. Not only do they have to issue the warning, but the person who is under discussion here has to accept the warning. So how likely is that? He has to say, yes, I recognize what you're telling me, and I accept it. It's interesting, there was a whole discussion, part of the debate in America and throughout the past few centuries, is the question of whether society even has the moral right to impose the death penalty. And there was an Italian philosopher whose name was Beccaria, Cesare Beccaria, who was very influential on the founding fathers, a part of this whole discussion. He lived around then, in the 1700s, and he had published a book opposing the death penalty, and a part of his argument was that the only reason government can do anything is because the people get together and they give over the right to govern to the association of the governing body. And therefore, they have authority because the people give them authority. So Beccaria wrote, so therefore, there can't be a concept of a death penalty because nobody would ever give over to anyone else the right to kill them. So therefore, it must be, it doesn't exist, there's no legitimacy to the government executing anybody. And other philosophers before and after him had discussed this position also, and they didn't think it was so compelling because they said this idea of the consent of the governed, that you're giving over to this central body the right to govern you, that's not a checklist where you say, okay, here's what you can do and what you can't do. You can tow my car, but you can't put me in jail, and you can give me a ticket, but you can't kill me. It doesn't work that way, because then nobody would say anything. Nobody would agree to any punishment. It means that you acknowledge the authority in general of the government, and then the government decides what they're going to do. So there were some who suggested, from a halachic perspective, they thought that's what was going on here also, that when the person accepts hasra, it's Gemara calls it yater atzmo lemisa, that he basically works into the system. So that's a way of acknowledging the governmental authority and saying, yes, I recognize that you have this power over me, and I'm a willing participant, so to speak. So already, that is very unlikely. Then it gets even harder, because the transgression has to happen within what we call toch kedei dibur of the warning. How long is toch kedei dibur? It ranges, for how long? It ranges anywhere between 3 and 9 seconds. So it has to happen at maximum 9 seconds after the warning. Why? So Rashi and Maseches Ksuvos suggests that if, I'm trying to see if I did I put it here? That, oh yeah, right. So here Rashi, you see source 6, Rashi and Maseches Ksuvos suggests, what's the reason? Why is it that you can't go more than 9 seconds? Shachachnu hasra. Maybe if more than that time elapsed, maybe we forgot. So can you imagine that? Right here, a person's life is at stake, and he's just been told and he's formally accepted it. And if 10 seconds go by, well, what do you expect? I'm supposed to keep everything in my memory? I'm supposed to remember that? Has it been 30 seconds already? You think I'm still paying attention? So it's a very difficult concept to understand. The Ketzos HaChoshen, in his commentary to Choshen Mishpat, so he doesn't understand how this could be, that we really think you're going to forget so quickly. And Rav Soloveitchik is quoted as having explained that it's not that we think you're going to forget, that it's going to be totally wiped out of your memory, that if somebody asks you about it, oh, you probably remember, yeah, there was some conversation a few seconds ago. The idea is that the purpose of Hasra, it's a whole discussion in the Talmud, it's a little bit beyond our scope, but the Gemara has a whole discussion, what is Hasra meant to accomplish? Is Hasra there because we think you really don't know at all what's going on, that you'd otherwise be a shogeg, that you're about to do this transgression, and you had no clue, you didn't realize there was anything wrong, so they have to give you hasra so we can confirm that you know what you're doing? Or is it something more than that? Or is it something else? what's the purpose of Hasra? So entering into that discussion, Rav Soloveitchik suggested that the purpose of Hasra is not just to confirm that you're aware that there's a prohibition here and that you're aware that there's a consequence. The purpose of Hasra is that we would only execute somebody who is so completely rebellious and so completely incorrigible that the action that they're doing is a complete and willful revolution against God and the Torah. And therefore, we need to ascertain, not just do you know that there's a problem here, but are you thinking about it actively as you perform the transgression? Is it a part of your conscious awareness? I think Rav Soloveitchik's language was, we have to figure out, ad heichan hu poreg ol, to what degree is this person throwing off all authority that it's so completely defiant that at the moment he's doing this, he's focusing on the fact that he is transgressing intentionally and willfully and with that full rebellion in mind. And anything short of that, that's not something that rises to the level of a execution-worthy offense. So that's the idea of Hasra. It has to come in such a direct sense. Hi.
I want to ask a question more generally.
Okay.
The Rabban had the power to do Machlis Margulis.
Oh, so we're going to get to that.
And it seems like, by focusing on the Olaitel level...
We're going to get to that. We'll get to that. That's what I'm saying, with different context. We'll get to that guy willing soon. Hi.
Hi. Couldn't the point that you explained of salvation, couldn't the Hasra make the Avera worse? Because the guy wasn't thinking about anything.
Yeah, maybe so. Right. But then again...
Put it in this context, he's saying,
So if he's willing to sign on to that, then again, it still puts him in the category. So it brings that risk, but at least it could be. I mean, it seems like it's really there to confirm that that's what's going on. But I guess if a person is willing to say, even so, then it does show you what kind of character is involved. There are a few other, just to mention a few other points that the Talmud has before we move on to the other context, but there are at least a few other rules that the Talmud has that just also displays just how unlikely it was that you're going to get executed. Some are a little bit more a part of the system of trying to make sure that our facts are correct, but some of the particularly striking halachos, for example, the Gemara says that if one of the dayanim, if one of the judges should witness the crime take place, so then he's disqualified from sitting on the trial, because Gemara explains that since he saw it happen, he's going to have a very hard time exonerating the person. And the idea seems to be that that's the goal. The goal is, as the Torah says, v'tzilu eda, to try to exonerate the individual under discussion. And this judge, unfortunately, he's going to be biased now because he actually saw it happen. We should mention that the whole structure of the Sanhedrin is very different from what we'd have, let's say, in an American court. In an American court, you have a prosecutor who's there to represent the government and is trying to make the case of guilt. You have a defense attorney who's there trying to make the case for innocence. The judge is there really to preside over everything. The jury is there to decide who is guilty or not, and the witnesses are there to provide the evidence and to provide the background. In the Sanhedrin, the system is really very different, that essentially the witnesses are really the prosecutors, the witnesses are there coming to make the case for guilt, and the Sanhedrin are the judge and the jury and the defense attorneys. They're all wrapped into one because they're going to ultimately vote on what's happening. They're also going to regulate the proceedings, and it's their job to argue for innocence. It's their job to find every possible side to exonerate the person under discussion. And in terms of this vote, there is a particularly fascinating halacha, which is subject to some debate in Rishonim as to what it means. But the most common interpretation, I think we put it here, is, source number 4, Amar Rav Kahana, Sanhedrin Shiro Kulam Lachova. Right, so in America, the jury system, especially in a capital case, right, you have to have everyone agree. You have to have a unanimous vote in order to decide that this individual is guilty. So in the Sanhedrin system, what do you need? You need not to have a unanimous vote. That if you have a unanimous vote, Sanhedrin Shiro Kulam Lachova, Potrinosa. Sounds like that means, the understanding of most Rishonim, is that it means that he is exonerated. That if everybody decides he's guilty, so then he gets off the hook. So this is a fascinating concept, and the Rishonim discussed different perspectives on this, and some have pointed out that perhaps it reflects the idea that nothing can be so simple, that it's hard to imagine that any situation could be so black and white that nobody sees any other possibility here. We must be missing something. Something must be wrong. And it also reflects the fact, like we mentioned a minute ago, that the Sanhedrin is also supposed to play the role of defense attorney, and if they're all unanimous in voting for guilt, if nobody is voting for innocence here, there's something flawed in the process. There's not really due process that's necessary, and it's not going to work. The whole thing falls apart. Again, there's some debate in Rishonim if that's what it means, but that's the general perspective. Just parenthetically, there are some fascinating questions about the nature of honesty and justice. So, for example, the Rishonim have a discussion. The Rechaim and Chumash has a comment about this, that what would you do if, let's say, you were a member of the Sanhedrin and you're convinced that this guy is guilty? But you realize that every other judge is also going to vote that he's guilty. So if you vote that he's guilty, he's going to get off, because if everybody votes he's guilty, so then he's going to be exonerated. So can you vote that he's innocent so that he'll be convicted? So that's an interesting discussion about to what extent does one have to vote his conscience, or is one voting for the conclusion? Is one looking for what he thinks justice requires, or is one voting for what his opinion is? And then the chips fall where they may. That's the way the system is designed. So there's a lot to say about that. So fascinating discussion in general, but all of this shows that yes, the idea that the Sanhedrin is going to execute somebody extremely rarely, if that, we can understand. You put all these parts together, how likely is it that somebody is going to be executed? So that's in terms of that context. That's in terms of the Sanhedrin. But the question was raised, so, and it's also implied by the Gemara in the first source, so isn't that a little bit of a dangerous system? So what about people who are actually a threat to society? So are we going to allow that people can do whatever they want, and as long as they make sure to wait 30 seconds before accepting the hasra in front of the two witnesses, so they're never going to be punished and they're going to know they can do whatever they want? So clearly you're going to have a pretty lawless society. You're going to have a dangerous Wild West if nobody is going to be subject to any kind of punishment, because the system is designed to not allow that to ever happen. So here's the point that you were raising, that the Gemara does acknowledge that there is an alternate system, that there is a next tier, and this is the second context that we were talking about. The Gemara has the expression in a few places, Shamati Shamakin Ve'onshin Shalom Menadin, that I've heard, it's spoken about, that sometimes the Sanhedrin will makin v'onshin, they'll give malchus, they'll give other punishments, shalom and hadin, not necessarily in a straight legal sense, but they will act in an extra legal sense when there is a threat to society. So here there is an extensive discussion in Rishonim. The Ran in his Drashos has a big discourse about this, where he points out that this is essentially the king's role, really, that this is the government's authority. It's really not primarily about the Sanhedrin, except the Sanhedrin could function in this capacity also, but this is essentially Mishpat HaMelech, that this is the governmental role of keeping society safe, that if there is somebody who poses a threat to society and whatever system they have to ascertain that that's indeed the case, so then the government, the king, has the right to take action as necessary, and the Sanhedrin sometimes functioned in that role as well. There's a discussion in the Rishonim if they did that only during the time of the Beis HaMikdash, if they did that later, but that was always understood to be a part of society's role through its government, through the king, that society has to be protected. There has to be some way to figure out what's necessary to make sure people cannot just be wanton threats, and therefore there is this secondary system, this extra legal system, as the Gemara phrases it, makin v'onshin shalom min hadin. So this became a major part of the discussion in the early days of the State of Israel. For a long time, there was no application for this discussion. For a long time in history, there was no Jewish government, and therefore the question didn't really come up. In the early 1950s, in the early days of the State of Israel, so then there was a discussion, so should we have a death penalty here? Should we assume that we should go back to that system and that this is something that should be put into effect? So there's been a lot of debate about this in the history of the State of Israel. Two people have been executed. And a part of the discussion was that the assumption is, okay, we don't really have a Sanhedrin today. However you understand the nature of the government, certainly all the rules that are necessary to constitute the full-blown Sanhedrin with everything that comes with that, so that's not the context. We're not going to be imposing Misas Bezdin in that sense. But what about this second tier, this idea of the government protecting its citizens? So where does that come in? So the Mishpat HaMelech, so perhaps that's a good model. So what should happen from that understanding? So at that time, the rabbinic voices who were involved in the discussion assumed that it's not like we started off with, where we find so many different focuses for punishment, where we talk about atonement and we talk about supporting the Torah law and we talk about all those things. We don't have all of those goals if we don't have a Sanhedrin. Our primary goal is to protect society. That's what we're involved in. So the assumption was that if somebody could have life imprisonment, you could put somebody in jail forever, so then society will be protected from this person, and therefore there isn't a need to execute them. So that was the understanding at the time, that we don't really have a justification to execute people, because again, we don't have the Sanhedrin functioning in that capacity. And for the second tier, the protection of society, so that didn't require, under this evaluation, this assessment, it didn't require the imposition of the death penalty. Life imprisonment could serve that purpose instead. And of course, this is where a lot of the contemporary debate is building off of. Is that indeed still the case? Is life imprisonment effective? Does life imprisonment even mean life imprisonment? That's a major part of the question as well, because it's possible for that to change. And therefore, is society indeed protected? And of course, it doesn't fully acknowledge also the deterrent effect, that the purpose is not only to make sure that this perpetrator is not committing any more crimes, but the purpose is also to make sure that others don't commit the crime, seeing that this individual is able to survive. So this is where a lot of the debate is located, and that's a big part of the discussion as well. So the third context, which a little bit takes it into a different territory, is the question of what about a secular court? What about the American government? How does the American government evaluate all of this? When your friend the senator, your friend the president asks you, Rabbi, tell me, what does Jewish law say to me about this? So the fact is that secular court system is addressed in a different context. That one of the Sheva Mitzvos Bnei Noach, one of the seven Noahide commandments, is the mitzvah of din. And that's a mitzvah of justice, and that applies to all of humanity. We have six prohibitions in the Torah that apply to all of humanity, six prohibitions of the Sheva Mitzvos Bnei Noach. They're all derived from Sukkim in Bereishis and Noach, and discussed in the Gemara in Sanhedrin, conveniently around Daf Nun Ches, to be easy to remember. And we have six prohibitions, and we have one mitzvah, the mitzvah of din, the mitzvah of justice. So there is an interesting debate as to what exactly that means. A lot of it revolves around Parshas Vayishlach. Several weeks ago we read Parshas Vayishlach, and Shimon and Levi execute the whole city of Shechem. And there's a discussion in the Rishonim as to what could have justified that. Where is that coming from? So the Rambam's position, Hilchos Melachim, I think it's here, this is in source 8. So the Rambam's position is that they are, it's close to this, that the Rambam's position is that Shimon and Levi were carrying out the mitzvah of din, that the mitzvah of justice for the whole world requires that the six transgressions are enforced, and Shechem, in their attack on Dina, was that Shechem, the individual, was guilty of the violating the Noahide code. So therefore, Shechem, the city, had an obligation to police him, to punish him. That's the mitzvah of din. And because they failed to do so, so then Shimon and Levi were punishing the city for failure to fulfill the mitzvah of din. And the Ramban, it's the last source here, the Ramban disagrees. The Ramban disagrees. The Ramban says that that's not the pshat in the story, And the implication is that they were right in doing this according to what the Rambam is saying, and that's not the way the Chumash sounds. It sounds like they were wrong, and Yaakov at least was angry at them. So if Yaakov was angry at them, it seems to suggest that they didn't do the right thing. So the Ramban argues with the Rambam on a couple of levels, but the Ramban basically says that he understands, it's actually a big chiddush, that the mitzvah of din means that the Choshen Mishpat that we have, the code of civil law, with all of the details, everything that Daf Yomi is finishing up now, Bava Kama, Bava Metziah, Bava Basra, all that stuff, that applies to the whole world. That's not just regulations for Jews, that applies to everybody. It's a huge chiddush, and it's fascinating. There is a lot of debate that circles around this opinion. Just to mention very quickly, there was a fascinating tshuva of Rav Nassim Gestetner, who was a posek in Bnei Brak, who passed away about 10 years ago. So he had a tshuva, it was probably written in the 1960s or so, where he was writing to a woman who was a Holocaust survivor. And she was receiving reparations from the German government. And there was a fight with her husband. She was in a fight with her husband about whether the husband had any rights to this money through marital property. Was it just hers alone, or did the husband have any rights to this money? So he discusses the whole question, what is the nature, halachically, of these reparations? What exactly is the category that addresses them? So he notes this Ramban in Vayishlach, where the Ramban says that all of Choshen Mishpat, all of Jewish civil law, applies to the whole world. So in the Torah, we have a concept of chavala. We have a concept that if somebody wounds somebody else, so then there's an obligation to compensate. There's an obligation to pay for that. So maybe he says that should be the category, that this is what the Torah talks about as demei chavala, paying the consequences of having wounded somebody else. And if that's the case, the halacha recognizes that as her money alone. The husband doesn't have any say in that money. But then he goes on to say, but that's only according to the Ramban. What about the Rambam who disagrees? And he also notes that you could say, okay, so there is an obligation to pay if you wound somebody, but the German government in the 60s, 70s, whenever this was, they're not the perpetrators. The Nazis were the perpetrators, but the Nazis have been defeated, and now the German government is not the same people. So you could say, all right, the halacha does recognize a concept of an obligation of demei chavala, but these aren't the perpetrators. So then maybe this is just a gift. Maybe this doesn't qualify as demei chavala. So he says, no, that's where the Rambam comes in, because the Rambam says that there's the obligation of din, meaning that you have to regulate what happens in society. So therefore, the German government takes on the responsibility of making sure that this compensation happens, so therefore it reverts to the status of the Demei Chavala, and that was his conclusion, that it was her money alone, because it's in this category, because of his combination of the Rambam and the Ramban's understanding of what this mitzvah of din is. So when he talk about the mitzvah of din, it becomes a little bit more complicated, because now the pendulum seems to swing completely in the other direction. Because when it comes to din, so the Gemara actually says that there the death penalty is appropriate, and in fact, perhaps even more than that, it sounds like from the Gemara that it's appropriate for everything, that the standard punishment for a violation of the Noahide code, the mitzvahs of Bnei Noach, is Misa, Asarasan, Zoe Misasan, is the language of the Gemara, that the existence of all of these prohibitions means that there is a death penalty associated. So that takes us too far. So then are we going to say that the halacha requires that the American government impose a death penalty for everything? So no one advocates that, right? So where do we find an understanding here? What exactly is the category? How do we work with that? How do we work with the fact that if we're going to look to a Talmudic source that addresses the American government, it would seem that that's it. It would seem that there is a baseline of the death penalty for everything, and that's certainly not the position that we're advocating.
So,
maybe both. Yeah,
it's,
yeah, that the Gemara talks about in the context of understanding the system for Bnei Noach, that's the default. So we don't find that being advocated. So it's a discussion one, because it's certainly a challenging notion, and there are various suggestions. What's interesting is to consider for a moment the position of Rav Aaron Soloveitchik. I'll just share a story that seems to call into question a lot of what we've said so far. Many years ago, I'm dating myself because I'll be able to figure out when this was. So I was in a store, and there was a magazine, an issue of New York Magazine, I believe, that had a cover story, The 100 Smartest New Yorkers. Okay, so opened up the magazine. I was very proud to see that among the 100 smartest New Yorkers were two people who were associated with Yeshiva University. Okay, very nice. So one of the 100 smartest New Yorkers was Rav Aaron Soloveitchik, Zecher Tzadik Livracha. So there are just two problems, right? One problem is that he was not a New Yorker, that he lived in Chicago and commuted to New York. The second problem was that the picture with the article, the picture was of his brother, Rabbi Yosef Dov Soloveitchik. So besides those two problems, other than that, we were still very proud of him to see him in this article. And this wasn't a book, it was just a magazine. So it couldn't give all the information necessary to show the scientific proof that these were literally the 100 smartest New Yorkers. They weren't able to have such a rigorous treatment. So for each of the 100 people in this article, they just had the name, a picture of his brother, and a quote to, one quote just to show how smart they are. Right, one quote to display their wisdom. So what was the one quote that they had for Rav Aaron Soloveitchik? So here's where you can figure out when this was. Governor Pataki had just been elected governor of New York State. He had defeated the first Governor Cuomo, and Pataki ran on a pro-death penalty platform, that until then they hadn't been using the death penalty in New York, and it was a very contentious point, and he ran on the platform that it should be brought back. So at that point, Rav Aaron Soloveitchik, who was opposed, so he issued a warning to Governor Pataki, to the newly elected governor. He said that you should be very careful with this death penalty thing, and the Talmud says that a Sanhedrin that killed every 70 years is a bloody court. You should be very careful that New York State should not become a bloody state. So one could say that that contradicts everything we've been talking about, because we've been establishing that there are different contexts. There's the Sanhedrin, and then there's the extra legal Sanhedrin, and then there is the secular court system, all of which have different rules. So why is Rav Aaron quoting from this discussion about the Sanhedrin to the governor of New York? It would seem to be that he's going into the wrong context. It would seem to be that that's not really the relevant source. So in order to find the answer to this, you have to read another quote from Rav Aaron Soloveitchik in an even better magazine, the journal of the Yeshiva University Beis Medrash, called Beis Yitzchak. So Beis Yitzchak is published every year by the yeshiva. So a number of years ago, there was an article by Rav Aaron Soloveitchik about this mitzvah of din, about this idea that there is a mitzvah on secular society to regulate its citizens, and the implication that we have in the Gemara that it always involved the death penalty. So how could that be? So Rav Aaron suggested, and there are others who understood this way as well, that we opened up talking about the different purposes of punishment, what we're trying to accomplish. So he understood it that secular government, civil government, is there really just to keep people peaceful, to keep people from killing each other, and they have to do what they can to maintain law and order in society. That's what the Mishnah in Pirkei Avos says, right? That we should always daven on behalf of the government, because if not for their influence, people would eat each other alive. So we have this notion that that's the role here, and he says that's what the mitzvah of din is about. So when the Gemara says asarasa and zohi misasa, he says, what does it mean? It means that the judge, the civil judge, has the right to do what he needs to do to keep society safe. And that right is discretionary. So the discretion, as he understood it, goes up to and including the death penalty. So should the judge in America decide that they need to execute the defendant, the convict, in order to keep society safe, he has the right to do that. It would not be considered murder. That's within his discretion. However, because it is discretionary, so he has to think carefully what's necessary. How far do I have to go in order to keep society safe? And if I don't have to go that far, if it's possible to do something else, then society will still be protected. So then it would be proper to take that measure rather than to go all the way towards execution. So that is presumably what Rav Aaron was saying in the quote in New York Magazine. He was saying that look to the Sanhedrin, get philosophical influence, get conceptual guidance from the Sanhedrin, and we see that when it comes to their system, which is certainly very much reflective of the wisdom of the Jewish tradition, we see that they were very, very careful. We see that they didn't rush to execute anyone. They took many steps to make sure that they got everything right and that they knew what was necessary and what wasn't necessary. So when you make your decisions, you should also be careful to have a similar type of discretion, that since you have the right to decide what's going to happen here and what's not going to happen, so look to Jewish tradition, look to the attitudes that are displayed within the Talmud and allow that to inform your discretion and think very carefully about how you want to proceed here. And if you look, I'm not going to read it inside, but you'll have it here on the sources. So source number 7 is a tshuva of Rav Moshe Feinstein. And I guess not coincidentally, it was written to another New York governor. At least he did live in New York. Rav Moshe wrote to Hugh Carey, who had been the governor even earlier than that, in the 70s, addressing this question also of what should the attitude be about the death penalty. Somebody told me recently he was able to find the original letter in the Hugh Carey archives in the library. So here we have the Hebrew, where Rav Moshe wrote essentially a similar position, doesn't go through the same lumdus, but he clearly is on the one hand saying that the death penalty is not off the table when it comes to Jewish tradition. It is something that we recognize has a place, but at the same time, you see, he's clearly not advocating that every offender get the death penalty. He's saying that this is a part of how we support life by making sure that people cannot just wantonly engage in murder and the like. Here we have Psukim and Parshas Noach that address that point. But at the same time, it's something that we have to be very, very careful about. It's something that requires a lot of discretion, and that is a part of what we see conveyed by these two great Gedolim, both interacting with New York State governors, making this point that when the leadership turns to the Torah scholar and says, what does Jewish tradition say about this, it is a complex and nuanced point. And the point that we started with, that this general perception that it's meant to be on the books and also meant not to be utilized too often, may indeed be the correct conclusion. Maybe that is indeed the best attitude to take from this whole discussion. But hopefully we're able to illustrate here a little bit that it is a long path to get to that conclusion, and that in order to make sure that we are accurately reflecting what the Jewish tradition has to say, there's a lot to think about and a lot to analyze as we do that. So maybe I'll just quickly review what we spoke about, and we'll have a minute or two left for questions. So just to quickly go over what we spoke about, we discussed the fact that, yes, we have this tension between the fact that Torah clearly talks about and mandates the death penalty in many cases. At the same time, many are familiar with this discussion in Makos that the Sanhedrin shouldn't kill once every 70 years or ever. So seeming to suggest the combination that, yes, it's on the books, but shouldn't be put into practice too much. So the question is that the whole story, or is there more? So we noted that any source, any discussion, could come out of one of at least three contexts: the context of the Sanhedrin acting in ritual offenses, the context of the Sanhedrin acting in an extra-legal sense, and the context of B'nai Noach, which is regulated independently in the Talmud. And we talked about what the purpose of punishment is. We noted that the Rishonim have three different ways to count the mitzvah of the death penalty. The Ramban, who understands it as one mitzvah, Bi'art Rav Mikabecha, seems to be about protecting society. The Rambam, who has it as four, categorizing based on the severity of the punishment, apparently corresponding to level of atonement necessary. He's focused on rehabilitation, even in the next world sense. And the Bahag, who counts each offense separately, 36 different commandments, he's saying that every time there is a mitzvah in the Torah that has this punishment, this is there to support the law, and that's the purpose. So all of these are all concepts that others would agree with as well, and the Sanhedrin had all of those purposes. And it's true, the Sanhedrin had a system which was very reluctant to ever execute anyone. We mentioned some of the details, the fact that you have to have warning for witnesses, you have to be makabel the hasra. We mentioned how that was compared to the idea of acknowledging the role of government, that whole debate among the philosophers about the question of legitimacy of the government to execute anybody, and the idea of Hasra Tochidei Dibor, that it has to be just a few seconds before, Rashi suggests, otherwise you forget. We mentioned Rav Soloveitchik's approach, that it's there to confirm that you're actually thinking about this in a full rebellious state as this happens, because anything less than that does not merit execution. And we talked about a few other halachos, such as the idea that a judge is obligated to be on the defense team, and therefore if he sees the crime happen, he's disqualified. And more strikingly, that we need to have a non-unanimous verdict, that if the Sanhedrin is unanimous, we send them home, we send everybody home, and what exactly that represents in some of the discussions that connected to that. So certainly from the Sanhedrin in its ideal form, it was very hard to have anyone executed. But then we discussed the second level, what about somebody who is a threat to society? Are we going to really say that there's no system to take care of that? So that's not the case. The Gemara tells us, Bezimachim Va'onshin Shalom and Hadin, they did have the ability to act outside of the system if it was necessary to protect society. And as we noted, the Drashas Haran and others, that's really the function of the king. This is the Mishpat HaMelech. The Sanhedrin could work in that fashion as well. And that category was utilized in the contemporary discussion in the early days of the State of Israel. What should our attitude be? And that's an ongoing discussion and very much a part of what we're seeing today as a part of the back and forth about what's necessary to keep society safe and what approaches can a Jewish government take under that category. And then we discussed the non-Jewish governments of the world are regulated by the mitzvah of din. We mentioned the machlokus between the Rambam and the Ramban, what that mitzvah involves. The Rambam understands that it means enforcing the other six mitzvahs. The Ramban says really it's about civil law. And we discussed as an example of that the tshuva of Nachum Gestetner, that the reparations the German government was paying, how to categorize that in halacha. And he understood that because of the Ramban as an expression of the concept of demei chavala, of paying for an injury. And then together with the Rambam, he says even the later German government has responsibility of that because of the other component of the mitzvah of din. And the problem was that the Gemara says in the context of din, it seems the death penalty is appropriate for everything. And that certainly seems to be going too far. Nobody advocates that in practice. So the question is, why not? So we mentioned how Rav Aaron Soloveitchik was quoted in this magazine as telling the governor of New York to look to this statement of the bloody Beis Din as an influence. And we asked, why is that? If we're saying these are different contexts, they shouldn't be mixed. And so we mentioned that this seems to parallel what Rav Aaron wrote in an article in the Yeshiva University Journal, that the mitzvah of din and the punishment of misa is not meant to say that it has to automatically happen all the time, but it's a reflection of the fact that the judge has the need to keep society safe and has the discretion to do whatever he needs to, up to and including the death penalty, if that's his discretion. But because he does have this discretion, he should use it wisely and carefully, and therefore looking to the collective history of the Sanhedrin is an appropriate place to look for such inspiration. And we noted this seems to be very compatible with what Moshe Feinstein wrote to another New York governor, to Hugh Carey, and that brings us back to where we started, that it does seem to be perhaps a reasonable conclusion to balance the various sources in the way that it's commonly understood, but there's much to discuss to get to that point, much nuance, and God should protect us and give our leadership the wisdom and the understanding necessary to make sure that the decisions that are made are both ideally protective society and fully reflective of the Chachma the Torah has to offer on this topic. So would you like to pick on the Kahash? How should we choose? Okay, so we'll go this way. Okay, hi.
Concerning the current debate in Israel about the death penalty for terrorism,
right,
it could be argued that it's part of war and basically it's our way of...
So that's a fascinating...
It's much different than...
Right. So that is a fascinating discussion, so I'm going to have to come back to that one, because war gets its own discussion. That requires a lot of details just to see exactly how halacha regulates war. It doesn't seem like it's being carried out that way. That theoretically, the decisions that are made on the battlefield seem to correlate to that. It makes sense to say that this is a part of how you interact with the population that you're at war with, but... Correct me if I'm wrong, it doesn't seem like that's the nature of the discourse. The discourse is looking at citizens who are offenders and how the government should deal with that. You're right that it affects an ongoing conflict between larger populations. Correct me if I'm wrong, it doesn't seem like the discussion is being framed that way. You're right that there is an interesting consideration. Maybe the battlefield discussions are more tied into that. Once you've left the battlefield, even though it certainly impacts the whole nature of the interaction, it seems we've moved into civil territory, and there's a significant difference between the two. But there is a lot to say about that, so you know, I'll be happy to come back and talk about that someday. Okay, so we're going in order. Skelbnik, who's
okay, hi. Okay, by the issues of emotion and of violence on nature, do you think they're hinting that the reason for the death penalty in a secular society is more preventative, as or because you have something like Shofet Dama Dama, saying that you know death penalty is the right thing to do if you're sure that, that the person is Hayatisti or really did it. Do you think they're hinting that they feel that the reasons for that kind of sacrifice are more as prevention, or they can still go in either way and see that kind of has other reasons for it as well?
So I think if I understand your question correctly, you're saying that one could look at the Psukim and Parshas Noach and say that there is an ideal here, that if the Torah is saying that if somebody kills someone else, so that's the proper retribution. Shofech dam ha'adam damo yishofech. And not that that's just necessary as a deterrent, that that's what should happen. So is that the position? And the only hesitance is that we don't know for sure. There's all kinds of problems with the judicial system, and there's all kinds of questions about actual guilt and fairness, and so that's where the hesitancy comes from. Or is the hesitancy that really it's only justified if it's necessary to protect society, and therefore it has to remain on the table for that purpose? But should there be any other way to do it, then that's the preferred way. So I think from Rav Aaron's perspective, it's more that way. Rav Moshe thinks a little more open to question whether he was somewhere in the middle of those. Hi.
Two things. Number one, the
Orach
Chaim that you quoted.
You want to know where it is? I'll have to find it.
Within the context of
I think it's on Acher Rabim Lahatos, I think.
Right.
I think it's on the pasuk of Acher Rabim Lahatos.
As far as the Makim's ownership Shalom is up in. Now the Maran Sanhedrin has a couple of Mishnah about Kippur, Lechem Tzar, and this where you can't execute somebody according to all of the niceties of the rules of Beit Din.
Right.
And yet, so does that fit into Makim Onshin Shalom? Because the Gemara makes efforts to try and fit it somehow into it. It says, how can you kill it and you don't have angels? So is that part of Sanhedrin?
That's a part of system too. I think that's the only way to see it. It clearly doesn't fit the rules of, you're saying that because why should we worry at all about the first tier rules if we're talking about tier two? Because some understand
that the person who is executed in that fashion is executed in probably a more horrible way than somebody who fulfills all of the criteria.
Right, and that's like opens up a fascinating discussion really about formalism and consequentialism and the like, because here, yes, it's more painful, but the government is not actively killing him. So there is a sense of remove that, okay, we have to do what's necessary to protect society, but if we can do so without actually physically killing him, so then that maintains a certain preference because they're not actively doing it. And you're right that the consequence is going to be even more painful, but they're focused on accomplishing this goal without crossing that line, and that's what there seems to be a preference for, because which is a fascinating idea in and of itself. Hi.
Just to follow up on Robert Aaron's position, I think you said that he opposed the death penalty.
Yeah.
If you oppose the death penalty, you take it off the table entirely, and then this idea of it being at the discretion of the judge is then removed, because he doesn't have that discretion.
Well, there's different ways to oppose it. Yeah, there's different ways to oppose it. Opposing it doesn't have to mean that you think there's no place for it ever. A lot of the opposition, especially in American society, has been premised on the assumption that the system isn't necessarily fair, and the system isn't necessarily always equitable, and that there are mistakes. So that's among the reasons why one may oppose it. So one could have very strong opposition for those reasons, as indeed has been documented by many public officials, while still maintaining that, okay, it's on the table that when the circumstances happen that somebody is undeniably the perpetrator of a brutal murder, then they should be able to be subject to the death penalty. But there are those who feel that because there's so many flaws in the system, so that's a reason to oppose it practically. Okay, thank you so much. Everyone, a wonderful Arab Shabbos.
I'd just like to ask everybody if there are some volunteers
that could help make sure that the Onyx Shabbos downstairs could be properly set up if you're doing 3-4 people or 5.